Skin disease in pregnancy. On this edition of Audio Digest Obstetrics and Gynecology, Volume 67, Issue 18, for the week of September 21st, 2020. Fulfilling Great Expectations: Safe Medical Management of Skin Disease in Pregnancy, presented by Jenny E. Morosse, Associate Clinical Professor of Dermatology at the University of California, San Francisco School of Medicine, and Director of Medical Consultative Dermatology at Palo Alto Foundation Medical Group. She was recorded using teleconference software in compliance with current social distancing guidelines during the COVID-19 pandemic. Dr. Morosse.
In this lecture, I'll discuss the safe medical management of skin disease in pregnancy. First, we'll review the available pregnancy classifications, and then we'll discuss the management of skin disease in pregnancy, including atopic dermatitis, psoriasis, cutaneous lupus, pemphigus, skin infection, acne, and finally, cosmetic and surgical procedures. 80% of pregnant women use some kind of prescription or over-the-counter medications during pregnancy, and there's an average of 3 to 8 different medications that are used in pregnant women in the United States. The critical period for structural malformation is 20 to 70 days after the first day of the last menstrual period. So oftentimes this critical period is over before the woman even realizes that she's pregnant. In general, the prevalence for developmental disorders is 3% at birth and reaches 8% by age 5. So this is a statistic that I commonly use in my practice when I'm counseling patients for them to understand the baseline risk of developmental disorders in the general population, independent of medications. Risk communication when discussing medication safety in pregnancy is very important. And unfortunately, references that patients may see online or see when they look up medications through textbooks contain phrases to protect the manufacturers from liability. There really are two different situations that are important to understand in terms of risk communication of medication safety in pregnancy. So the first is how to communicate the risk before a pharmacotherapeutic choice has been made, or before a pregnancy is initiated. And the second is what to say when the drug exposure has already taken place. In the case that a drug exposure has taken place, you want to make sure that you contact the state teratology information service or pregnancy risk information centers. Often specialists will recommend non-invasive prenatal diagnostic procedures, such as detailed fetal ultrasounds, to assess the fetus for developmental abnormalities. You want to avoid referencing experimental results, case reports, and really reassure the patient and give very straightforward answers. There are 3 international pregnancy classifications that have been developed. The first was in Europe, called the Swedish Catalog of Approved Drugs, or the FASS. In addition, there are 3 other classification systems that were developed in the Netherlands, Denmark, and Germany. In the US, the Food and Drug Administration developed a system, and then finally, the Australian Drug Evaluation Committee developed a system as well. And when you compare these 3 widely accepted classification systems, only 1/4 of medications appear in the same risk category. So why is there such a difference in perceived risk from continent to continent? In order to understand this, if you put the US Food and Drug Administration system and the Swedish catalog side by side, you will quickly see that category C for the US FDA administration is very similar to the Swedish catalog of approved drugs, category B. In both situations, human data is not available and animal studies are used primarily. The US FDA administration system states in class C that animal studies showed adverse fetal effects and human data is not available. The Swedish catalog shows in their classification B that human data is not available and animal data are used instead. So the US FDA system places much more focus on the availability of animal data. When comparing the US FDA system versus the Swedish catalog, it was felt that the US FDA system creates a system that it's innocent until proven guilty. And over 1,000 doctors and pharmacists were interviewed and found that the European system was favored by far over the US FDA system because the FDA focuses too much on animal data and places most medications as class C, which is risk cannot be ruled out, which is often not helpful for the physician or their patient. To address this, there have been other textbooks and classification systems that have been developed. One in particular that was developed by Schaefer, Peters, Miller, and colleagues is entitled Drugs During Pregnancy and Lactation, and this is an evidence-based medicine text. And it divides the pregnancy up into three different time intervals. There is the embryonic period, that's to week 12, the fetal period, that's from week 13 to the last month gestation, and the peripartum period, which is the last month gestation. And at each of those time intervals, they develop an assessment where one is the drug of first choice and it's well tolerated, two is a drug of second choice with insufficient experience, S is single or low dosages are tolerable, T is potentially teratogenic or toxic, and C is contraindicated, that there would be no rational indication to use the medication. There are advantages of this evidence-based medicine system over the US FDA system. First, the risk changes throughout the pregnancy, depending on if it's the first trimester or immediately prior to the birth of the child. So, for example, the US FDA system for clotrimazole is class B, and nystatin C, and diphenhydramine is B. The evidence-based medicine system will show that during the embryonic period, nystatin would be preferred over the clotrimazole derivative, but otherwise, during the fetal and peripartum time interval, they are both considered to be very safe. Another example would be diphenhydramine, which is considered safe up until the peripartum period, and in the last month of pregnancy, it's best to use diphenhydramine at lower doses and carefully to avoid potential side effects from the diphenhydramine just during that last month of pregnancy. The second advantage of the evidence-based medicine system over the US FDA is that more weight is given to medications that have been around for longer and stood the test of time. An example of that would be the anti-tumor necrosis factor alpha biologics that are used for psoriasis versus topical corticosteroids. The US FDA system has placed topical corticosteroids as class C due to the teratogenic effects that I will discuss later at very high superpotent doses of the topical corticosteroids when they were administered systemically in animal models. However, the evidence-based medicine system indicates that these are safe throughout the pregnancy, and I will review data to support that during the course of the lecture. The US FDA system indicates that the anti-TNF biologics are class B, but the evidence-based medicine system indicates that they have to be used judiciously, so it provides a more balanced view. Third, the evidence-based medicine system tends to be more reasonable and coincide with common sense. It makes intuitive sense that prescribing something like hydrocortisone would be safer to do than prescribing the anti-TNF biologics. But if you look at the US FDA system, you would see that it appears that they're recommending using something such as infliximab over that of hydrocortisone, which doesn't coincide with common sense. There is a resource that we developed in the Journal of the American Academy of Dermatology in March 2014 that has a handout that's both front and back that can be used to pin up in your office that lists the safety of dermatologic medications in both pregnancy and lactation. It is summarized so that the Australian, European, and US pregnancy classifications are listed for all major dermatologic medications, and it is an excellent quick reference during clinic when you're prescribing dermatologic therapy during pregnancy. There is a new FDA pregnancy and lactation label ruling, which is referred to as the PLLR, and this new ruling took place in December 2014. They are doing away with the A, B, C, D, X categories, and instead the information is conveyed in narrative sections. There's also contact information for pregnancy registries, as well as a breastfeeding section, and a section that talks about use in reproductive age for both females and males. This was effective as of June 30th, 2015, and all medications are being phased in over time so that this information will be available to clinicians. There are two publications that can be used that provide information on how to access the PLLR information. This includes a Journal of American Academy of Dermatology publication in 2015 entitled The New U.S. Food and Drug Administration Pregnancy and Lactation Label Rules, The Impact on Clinical Practice, as well as a publication in the International Journal of Women's Dermatology in 2016 that's entitled Understanding the New FDA Pregnancy and Lactation Label Ruling. Now I'm going to move on to discussing management of skin disease in pregnancy, and this includes atopic dermatitis, psoriasis, pemphigus, cutaneous lupus, skin infection, acne, and surgical procedures as well as cosmetic procedures. The debate regarding the teratogenicity of systemic cortisones that can be used in atopic dermatitis patients began in the 1950s when it was found that systemic cortisone in pregnant mice caused an increased risk of cleft palate. Now, prospective studies done in humans since that time show no evidence of malformation risk, but epidemiologic studies show that there is an increased risk of oral cleft palate, and a meta-analysis showed that this oral cleft palate risk increases by 3.4-fold over that of the general population, which is consistent with animal studies. If it is necessary to use systemic cortisones during pregnancy, betamethasone and dexamethasone cross the placenta very well. Prednisone crosses to a much smaller extent, so it is the preferred choice of a systemic steroid during the course of the first trimester. In terms of topical corticosteroids, these are the only dermatologic topical therapy that is in the Cochrane database. This was very thoroughly analyzed to show safety of topical corticosteroids throughout pregnancy, where in this Cochrane review, they reviewed all cohort and case control studies in 11 databases, and they used multi-country case control studies as well as population case control studies in tens of thousands, sometimes hundreds of thousands of patients to show the safety over time. If possible, it's important to limit the amount of topical corticosteroid to 300 grams. Oftentimes, dermatologic medications are dispensed in 45 or 60 gram tubes, so you should keep track of the amount of medication that you're dispensing throughout the course of the pregnancy. And a population cohort study that was published by Dr. Chi in 2013, they found that there was potentially an increased risk of low birth weight infants when the dispensed amount of the potent topical corticosteroids exceeded 300 grams. Of course, this could be due to the underlying medical issues that the mother was experiencing and not directly related to the topical corticosteroid use, but it still is good to keep track of how much medication is being dispensed throughout the course of the pregnancy. And when possible, dilute the topical corticosteroid with a moisturizer so that it can be used more diffusely and less medication is used as well as dispensed. The same study did show that there was no association of maternal topical corticosteroid use in pregnant women versus controls. And this is regarding oral facial cleft development, preterm delivery, fetal death, and Apgar score. So the study did confirm that topical corticosteroids are safe to use during pregnancy. In terms of first-generation antihistamine, antiemetics are often used for first trimester nausea and vomiting. Hydroxyzine has a slightly higher increased risk of congenital malformation, which is 5.8%. So it is not a recommended antihistamine in the first trimester. Also, there was one case control study in The Lancet in 1974 that showed an increase in cleft palate with diphenhydramine, but this has not been shown to be the case in subsequent years. So diphenhydramine still is considered a safe antihistamine in the first trimester. In terms of second generation antihistamines, loratadine is considered first line and cetirizine is considered second line. There are three counseling points that are important to keep in mind in terms of antihistamine use in the last month of pregnancy, as I referenced earlier. First, the antihistamines can have oxytocin-like effects and can stimulate uterine contractions, particularly if they're given in IV or overdose. Second, there are reports of increased rates of retrolental fibroplasia in premature infants. This was published in the American Journal of Epidemiology, where they showed that there was a 22% versus 11% risk of developing retinopathy of prematurity if any antihistamine was given within 2 weeks of delivery. So this would be a counseling point for patients that are at risk of developing pregnancy contractions earlier, resulting in premature infants. Thirdly, there have been withdrawal symptoms that have been reported in infants for mothers who were regularly taking high doses of antihistamine. Tremulousness, irritability, poor feeding, and diarrhea have all been reported. There was a mother on 150 milligrams a day, which is a very high dose of hydroxyzine, where the infant developed tonic-clonic seizures that were thought to be a manifestation of withdrawal. So this is also an important counseling point for patients. In terms of immunosuppression that might be used for our atopic dermatitis patients, mycophenolate mofetil patients, which is CellCept that is often used for severe atopic dermatitis, needs to be treated just as we treat our isotretinoin or Accutane patients. Contraception should be used at least 4 weeks prior to therapy and 6 weeks after completing therapy. And also, patients cannot use hormonal contraception alone because mycophenolate mofetil has been shown to affect the efficacy of the oral hormonal contraception. In addition, if patients use azathioprine for their atopic dermatitis, they cannot use the IUD alone because there have been multiple reports of pregnancies with the IUD in place. Tipifilimab does not appear to have any safety signals in the first trimester, but at this point, there are a minimal number of patients in the registry. So although there are no safety issues, we recommend against its use during pregnancy. In terms of psoriasis in pregnancy and postpartum, I published a study in the Archives of Dermatology in 2005 that examined the hormonal effect on psoriasis in pregnancy and postpartum. We found in this study that there is a significantly increased chance that the psoriasis will be treated by the pregnancy alone. Up to 55% of women's psoriasis improves during the course of pregnancy. Following the birth of the child, the psoriasis will worsen 65%, so there appears to be a postpartum flare following the birth of the child. For those that are in that 55% who improve, the improvement is actually quite dramatic, with an average of 80% of the body surface area clearing during the course of pregnancy. So for half of patients, the pregnancy itself will significantly help the patient's psoriasis. If the patient does not experience improvement during the course of pregnancy, there are safe forms of therapy for her to take for her psoriasis during pregnancy. UVB, ultraviolet B light, is generally considered the safest form of therapy. There is photodegradation of vitamins, in particular folic acid, and as we know, low folic acid levels does result in an increased risk of neural tube defects in infants. So all patients who are undergoing light therapy should be on folic acid supplementation. In a study that we published in the Journal of American Academy of Dermatology in 2009, we compared two studies, one that was published in the Egyptian Dermatology Online Journal and another that was published in the Journal of American Academy of Dermatology. The Egyptian Dermatology Online Journal showed that with 42 exposures of the light therapy, the folate levels decreased from an average of 8 to 6, which was a significant decrease during the course of those 42 treatment sessions. Usually light therapy is given about 3 times a week. So this is a very significant decrease in their folate levels. There were no patients during that period of time that reached folate deficiency levels, which are defined as 3.7 nanograms per milliliter. However, for all patients that are on light therapy, we recommend supplemental therapy with folic acid to decrease the chance of risk of neural tube defects. Also, PUVA therapy, which is sorolin plus UVA, ultraviolet A light, has been shown to decrease folic acid levels in serum as well. In terms of oral systemic therapy for psoriasis, cyclosporin is generally considered to be safe in pregnancy. Most of the literature comes from the transplant population that showed that there was no increase in malformation risk in over 1,000 births. There is a potential for growth restriction, but this is very difficult to assess given the fact that there are multiple medical problems that the patients that are on cyclosporin are experiencing. And as I stated, this is mostly from transplant literature and these patients tend to be very sick. So the growth restriction could be due to the patient's underlying illness as opposed to the cyclosporin itself. Cohorts of children have been followed for 2 to 3 years after birth, showing that there are no neurodevelopmental, immunologic, or nephrogenic defects that appear in the children. So this does appear to be a safe medication to be using during pregnancy. In terms of apremilast, which is another oral medication for psoriasis, it's a phosphodiesterase inhibitor. At this point, this has very little safety data. So there does appear to be a dose-dependent increase in abortions and fetal deaths in monkeys when doses greater than 2 times were used of the human dose. So even though no malformations in mice have been seen, and also no malformations have been reported in humans, because we have very little safety data, we do not recommend using apremilast during pregnancy at this point in time. In terms of biologic medications for psoriasis, anti-TNF agents have been studied very extensively at this point. The anti-TNF class is the tumor necrosis factor alpha class of medications that was first used for psoriasis. And these tend to be IgG antibody-based medications. Maternal antibodies are transported across the villi by neonatal Fc receptors to provide immunity to the newborn. And this starts early, the second trimester, and it increases exponentially just prior to delivery, as if to give an immune boost to the infant of antibodies right before the baby is being delivered. So the vast majority of the antibodies will cross over the placenta during the third trimester. And it requires this neonatal Fc receptor in order to cross. These antibodies can be present in the infant serum up to 6 months of age. Infliximab, adalimumab, ustekinumab are all IgG monoclonal antibodies, and they have a large hydrophilic protein structure, so they need to use this Fc receptor. The only TNF agent that is not an IgG antibody is etanercept, and this is a fusion protein, so this is going to cross by placenta, simple diffusion. It's transferred less in the third trimester, so in cord blood, the presence of the etanercept is about 4 to 7% of the maternal serum level versus infliximab is 160% of the maternal serum level, and adalimumab is 153% of the maternal level. So these antibodies that are IgG are more prominent in the cord blood during the last portion of the third trimester. There was a case of an infant death in a mother who was taking infliximab for her Crohn's disease in an area of England that was endemic of tuberculosis. And this was during pregnancy that she received the infliximab every 8 weeks. at 10 milligrams per kilogram, and her infant was born completely healthy until the infant received the BCG vaccine that was given as a live vaccine at 3 months of age. And the infant developed a widespread eczematous dermatitis, head lag, and poor weight gain, and died at 4.5 months of disseminated BCG. So live vaccines should not be given in the first 7 to 8 months of life as a result of the potential immunosuppression of the infant because of the exposure to infliximab in utero. Sertolizumab is the only TNF agent that does not have the FC region that's required for placental transfer. It's the only pegylated anti-TNF without this FC region. In a study of patients that were over 30 weeks pregnant, sertolizumab levels were below, which is less than 0.032 micrograms per milliliter in all the infant samples that were taken at birth, and essentially was undetectable. So sertolizumab does not appear to cross the placenta during pregnancy. And there were no safety signals using sertolizumab for these mother-infant pairs during the course of the pregnancy and postpartum. So this does appear to be a safe biologic agent for psoriasis during pregnancy. I'm now going to move on to pemphigus in pregnancy. So fetal skin shares the same desmoglein 3 profile as adult oral mucosa. So neonatal pemphigus will be more likely if the mother has oral disease. Even if her pemphigus over her entire body and cutaneous skin is controlled, if she does have oral lesions, this puts the neonate at risk. And there is an increased risk of fetal demise should she have increased desmoglein 3 profile. So it is important for the babies to be monitored. There is a transient neonatal pemphigus that can last a few weeks because of the transplacental passage of IgG4 antibodies. There is no direct correlation between the severity of the mother's disease and the extent of neonatal involvement, so she can have very minimal disease during the course of pregnancy, but the baby can be severely involved. I'm going to discuss a case of pemphigus that I managed for a pregnant woman through a course of 2 of her pregnancies. In her first pregnancy, she was referred to me at about 20 weeks gestation, and with her prior dermatologist, she had been using clobetasol, which is a class 1 very potent topical corticosteroid, as well as doses of daily oral prednisone ranging from 40 to 60 milligrams, which was a very high dose for her size and weight. I applied for IVIGG, which we started at 26 weeks gestation, but she had an emergent C-section at 30 weeks gestation, and the baby was born at just 2 pounds. The mother also developed HELLP syndrome, hemolysis, elevated LFTs, low platelet count. She developed gestational diabetes from the prednisone use, and also the baby experienced intrauterine growth retardation as a result of the chronic corticosteroid use. So for her second pregnancy, in preparation, we started her on IVIG, and she continued taking the IVIG at a dose of 20 grams, which was 0.5 grams per kilogram, every 4 weeks prior to the initiation of pregnancy and throughout her entire pregnancy. She was able to completely discontinue all oral corticosteroid therapy, and she gave birth at 38 weeks gestation. The baby was 4 pounds 11 ounces and did not require any time in the NICU, and the pregnancy was much more successful than the first pregnancy, and the IVIG worked extremely well. There is literature to support the efficacy and safety in pregnancy and pemphigus treatment. You can refer to the Journal of European Academy of Dermatology and Venereology in 2011. There's a publication entitled Use of Intravenous Immunoglobulin Therapy During Pregnancy in Patients with Pemphigus Vulgaris. The intravenous immunoglobulin improves the chance of in vitro fertilization because up to 10% of infertility cases are thought to be due to antibody-mediated disease. And IgG antibodies begin to cross the placenta around 32 weeks gestation, so it is a very safe therapy for the majority of the pregnancy. and is an excellent way to control a case of severe pemphigus or other blistering disorders throughout the pregnancy. The therapeutic ladder for pemphigus therapy in pregnancy is as follows. We use topical corticosteroids when possible, but if the patient does require systemic therapy, we use corticosteroids at the lowest effective doses. And if a patient is requiring more than 20 milligrams of prednisone a day, you should consider initiating IVIG, azathioprine, or dapsone. Also, rituximab has been used, but needs to be used judiciously during pregnancy. This therapeutic ladder is described in Dermatologic Therapy, in a publication entitled Treatment of Dermatologic Connective Tissue Disease and Autoimmune Blistering Disorders in Pregnancy. I'm now going to discuss cutaneous lupus in pregnancy. There's a classic rule of thirds in pregnancy where a third of patients improve, a third worsen, and a third stay the same. Another way of saying this is that 60% of pregnant women will flare versus 40% of non-pregnant women. So lupus does tend to flare during the course of pregnancy. There is a 2 to 3-fold increased risk of disease flares, and the most common organ system to flare is the skin, with up to 90% of patients experiencing a flare of their skin during the course of pregnancy. Also, lupus nephritis is common and is present in up to 75% of patients. It's important to note that aggravation of the skin can be a sign that the internal disease is active. And it's very important to distinguish between lupus nephritis and preeclampsia, even though distinguishing between the two can be difficult. Both are associated with hypertension, proteinuria, and hematuria. In 2006, Klaus and colleagues published a prospective study where they examined 3 groups of patients with systemic lupus erythematosus in pregnancy. And they divided the patients into 3 groups where there is no exposure to hydroxychloroquine, continued use of hydroxychloroquine, and cessation of hydroxychloroquine 3 months prior to conception. They found that there was no difference in fetal outcomes, such as miscarriage or fetal abnormalities in all 3 groups, but there was a higher degree of lupus activity if hydroxychloroquine was stopped. And the patients that continued to use hydroxychloroquine required less systemic corticosteroid. So it is important to understand that hydroxychloroquine should be continued throughout the entire course of pregnancy. For patients that have lupus during pregnancy, there's an increased risk of spontaneous abortion, fetal death, intrauterine growth retardation, and preterm delivery. Those conditions can occur in up to 60% of patients. This is particularly true if the patient has anticardiolipin antibodies, lupus anticoagulant, lupus nephritis, and hypertension. Low-dose aspirin can prevent miscarriages, and 30% of patients have anti-Rho antibodies that can result in a neonatal lupus erythematosus that can last up to 6 months. Also, patients that have anti-Rho antibodies have an increased risk of their infant developing congenital heart block. It's a 2 to 3% risk, and this heart block can be detected at 18 to 20 weeks through a detailed fetal ultrasound. I'm now going to move on to skin infection treatment during pregnancy, and I will discuss bacterial infections, fungal infections, viral infections, including herpes and human papillomaviral infections, as well as infestations such as scabies and lice. So for pyogenic infections, empetigo should be treated with topical mupirocin as first line. Also, oral first-generation cephalosporins and oral dicloxacillins are also considered first line. For a patient who's developed cellulitis, oral or IV penicillin and oral first-generation cephalosporins and dicloxacillin can be used. For a methicillin-resistant Staphylococcus aureus infection, clindamycin can be used. Abscesses should be treated with incision and drainage, and antibiotics are not recommended unless the abscess is greater than 5 centimeters or there is a 2-centimeter zone of erythema surrounding the abscess where there is a concomitant cellulitis and abscess present. First-line oral antibiotics for a complicated staphylococcus or streptococcus skin infection include penicillin, first-generation cephalosporins, and dicloxacillin. Macrolides are often mistakenly thought of as first-line choice, but they are second-line choice. Erythromycin is preferred over azithromycin and clarithromycin because we have more data for erythromycin. But it's important to know that atrial and ventricular septal defects, as well as pyloric stenosis, has been reported to be increased with first trimester use of erythromycin. Erythromycin estelate should be avoided because there's an increase of AST in the second trimester, and this hepatotoxicity occurs in 10% of cases and is reversible. Erythromycin base and erythromycin ethyl succinate do not have this associated risk. Clindamycin is generally considered to be safe. There is an inducible resistance to clindamycin that's been reported, so you need to test for the ERM gene, and the sensitivities are performed by the lab using the D test. So it's important to make sure that your lab is performing that test to look for inducible resistance. In terms of rifampin, it is actually the treatment of choice of tuberculosis in the developing world. Mother and fetus both have to receive peripartum vitamin K prophylaxis to prevent hemorrhagic complications, but there are no associated developmental abnormalities associated with rifampin. Sulfonamides are considered a second-line choice up until the third trimester. They are contraindicated peripartum due to the risk of hemolytic anemia, hyperbilirubinemia, and kinicteris. Trimethoprim is associated with a decrease in folic acid levels. So if it is used in the first trimester, it is recommended to take at least 0.5 milligrams a day of folic acid when taking the trimethoprim. It has been reported to be a potential teratogen in the first trimester. So ideally, trimethoprim should be avoided in the first trimester. Also, the combination of sulfamethoxazole and trimethoprim is associated with low birth weight and prematurity. It was initially thought regarding the quinolones that there would be a high risk of cartilage damage and arthropathy, but human case reports do not show this to be the case. Cipro and norfloxacin have been studied the most, so these would be the preferred quinolone antibiotics to use for a complicated infection in the first trimester. Tetracyclines are considered second-line therapy for a complicated infection up until 14 weeks gestation. They are considered to be contraindicated after 15 weeks due to the bone growth inhibition, teeth discoloration, as well as the potential for maternal hepatitis. For complicated infections that require IV antibiotics, vancomycin is considered safe, but there is a risk of ototoxicity, so it should be avoided in the first trimester if possible. Linzolid is also considered safe, but animal studies do show potential for phytotoxicity and teratogenicity at very high doses, so it really should be reserved for only complicated infections. Daptomycin is another choice that's considered safe, and it can be used for life-threatening infections unresponsive to vancomycin. I'm now going to move on to fungal infections. So for topical tinea corporis or ringworm, all topical therapy, including clotrimazole, miconazole, and ketoconazole, would be considered safe during pregnancy. Data are more limited for topical terbinafine, naftafine, and ciclopirox, but they're also likely safe. Nystatin is a very safe topical therapy to use because it's not absorbed by skin or mucous membranes, but it is less effective than the imidazole derivatives. Also, clotrimazole, miconazole, and ketoconazole has been used in animals at high doses intravaginally with no defects. The data are more limited for topical terbinafine, naftafine, and ciclopirox, but they're also likely safe. And topical gentian violet is a very safe solution to use at concentrations of 0.5 to 1%. This has been reported to be safe in both the fetus as well as the mother, but it will stain the area that the topical gentian violet was applied. For tinea versicolor, patients should be advised to wait to treat until pregnancy is complete because this is considered a cosmetic condition, or they can use limited application of clotrimazole or miconazole, which is thought to be safe. Also, zinc pyrithione soap or topical benzoyl peroxide soap can be used for more widespread areas. The benzoyl peroxide is quickly converted to benzoic acid in the skin which is in food. So the patient is getting more exposure to benzoic acid in their food than they are from the application of the topical therapy. Selenium sulfide is also a good choice, and this is present in a variety of anti-dandruff shampoos. Limited application is very safe with minimal absorption. Selenium levels have been reported to rise if selenium sulfide is used on damaged skin for prolonged periods of time, and selenium poisoning has been reported to result in miscarriage. So caution should only be advised if the patient has damaged skin and plans to use the therapy for prolonged periods of time. In terms of systemic antifungals, fluconazole, ketoconazole, and itraconazole are all imidazole derivatives, and they are not advised during pregnancy because there have been reports of developmental malformation resembling the Antley-Bixler syndrome, so craniosynostosis, congenital heart defects, and skeletal anomalies have all been reported. In a study examining low-dose, short-term incidental exposure in the first trimester, there has not been shown to have an increase in risk of malformation with this very, very short-term exposure, but you still need to offer a detailed fetal ultrasound from 18 to 20 weeks to examine the infant carefully for abnormalities. Itraconazole can be used for a complicated systemic fungal infection, but there has been implications of heart failure, increased risk of spontaneous abortion, cleft palate, and limb defects in animals, so it needs to be used with caution. Oral griseofulvin is not recommended during pregnancy. There have been reports of conjoined twins with maternal use of oral griseofulvin during pregnancy. Oral terbinafine does have a substantial amount of safety data that was recently published in JAMA Dermatology. I prepared an editorial entitled Oral and Topical Terbinafine for Fungal Infections in Pregnancy that is a good reference. However, if it's being used for a cosmetic condition such as onchomycosis, we do recommend avoiding the use during pregnancy and waiting until after the baby is born to use the oral terbinafine to treat cosmetic conditions. For a complicated infection, IV amphotericin can be used. It's a treatment of choice in serious disseminated mycoses, but it can be retained in the placenta and may cause a transient neonatal renal dysfunction. In terms of viral infections with herpes simplex virus or human papilloma virus, there are safe choices during pregnancy. Acyclovir would be the treatment of choice, but it is likely that famciclovir and valacyclovir are also likely safe. The data are more limited, so we tend to recommend acyclovir just because there is copious amounts of safety data showing its efficacy. American College of Obstetrics and Gynecology and the Center for Disease Control recommends treating primary HSV for 7 to 10 days during pregnancy, and then treating symptomatic recurrence of HSV for 3-day intervals during the course of pregnancy. You should only start prophylaxis at 36 weeks gestation if the patient is planning a vaginal delivery, but do not recommend routine daily prophylaxis throughout the entire pregnancy. In terms of the human papilloma virus, liquid nitrogen treatment, which is a non-medical therapy, is the treatment of choice. In terms of the drug of choice, trichloroacetic acid can be used for condylomata acuminata. For periungular verruca, squaric acid is a non-toxic, non-mutagenic alternative, or also injections with intralesional candida can be used. Salicylic acid is also a safe choice. Limited application has not been shown to bind platelets or cause Reye's syndrome. So this is a safe choice for a verruca during pregnancy. There are little data to support safe use of Pedophylox, cantharidin, or imiquimod, so we recommend avoiding those therapies during pregnancy. In animal studies, there were problems with weight gain and bone ossification with imiquimod, so we do recommend avoidance. Pedophylline is pregnancy class X, and it is contraindicated. There have been deaths in both mothers and fetuses, as well as psychiatric symptoms, ear, heart, and extremity malformations. In terms of scabies and lice therapy, the drug of choice in the United States is permethrin, which is a 5% cream. In Europe, the drug of choice is benzoyl benzoate, which is a 25% lotion. It is banned in the United States because its metabolite, benzyl alcohol, can cause neonatal fatal intoxication, which we refer to as gasping syndrome. Aloe vera has been shown to be comparable to benzyl benzoate in terms of its safety profile and efficacy, so that would be an additional choice. In addition, precipitated sulfur that can be prescribed in a 5 or 10% ointment is safe. Less than 1% is absorbed, so it is a therapy that is safe, but it's also less effective. Crotimeton is a 10% ointment or lotion, and this is also likely safe, but it's not as effective and fewer safety data are available. Malathion can cause respiratory depression in children less than 2 years of age, so we recommend avoiding its use, even though it is considered pregnancy class B. Just because of the fact that there are fewer safety data, we do not recommend that therapy. Lindane is contraindicated in pregnancy because there is up to 10% cutaneous absorption, and it has been associated with neurotoxicity, seizures, liver damage, hypersensitivity reaction, and aplastic anemia. The best therapy for head lice would be occlusive therapy, which would be non-medicated therapy. There is information online of how to treat head lice with cleansers such as Cetaphil that you apply to dry hair, drape a towel around the neck, and then apply the cleanser in copious amounts to the scalp, massage the cleanser into the scalp, and then comb out the hair with the cleanser. So it's preferable to use non-medicated therapy for head lice when available. If the patient does fail multiple attempts of occlusive therapy, permethrin cream can be used, as well as pyrethrin shampoo or benzyl alcohol. In terms of acne therapy, topical antibiotics are generally considered safe in pregnancy. I tend to use amoxicillin for an acne rosacea patient and cephalosporin such as Duracef, which is cefadroxil, for the acne vulgaris patients. Cefadroxil, out of all the cephalosporins, has the lowest rate of abnormality risk in the Briggs textbook, and so that is why I choose that particular antibiotic during pregnancy. You need to recommend that the patient avoids the use of spironolactone during pregnancy because there has been reports of it affecting the development of male genitals during the course of pregnancy. Topical tretinoin is a safe therapy to use during pregnancy. It's a vitamin A derivative that's applied to the skin to unplug the pores, and there have been several studies that show that there's no increased risk of birth defects with the use of topical tretinoin. There has been case reports indicating ear, cerebral, and cardiac malformation, but at this point it's very unclear that these were actually related to the use of tretinoin. In LexisNexis, which is law's equivalent of PubMed, there has been a report of the dermatologic topical medication tretinoin where it went through trial to final judgment. In Florida in 1993, there was a product liability case where Sarah Chavosky filed a suit against Ortho Pharmaceutical Corporation that manufactured tretinoin because her daughter, Honey, was born with an imperforate anus, bowl-shaped ears which lacked rims, and misshapen toes. The case was dismissed because it was felt that the teratogenic effect of tretinoin was inadequate. The defense had the chief of embryology and teratology of Mass General and the professor of pediatrics at Harvard stating that the patient developed a genetic condition called Townes-Brock syndrome, and the expert witness had no specialized training in embryology or teratology, did not know of any study documenting absorption rate of tretinoin, and also could not confirm the birth defects were associated with tretinoin or isotretinoin, so the case was dismissed. That being the case, if a medication is not medically necessary, we generally avoid its use in pregnancy. So, for example, if a patient would like to treat their androgenetic alopecia, oral minoxidil is something that can cause a diffuse fetal hypertrichosis that disappears the first 3 months of life. So we tend not to recommend the use of topical minoxidil. Also, there have been case reports of topical minoxidil as a potential teratogen. One case report indicated that there was an enlarged heart, aortic stenosis, enlarged sigmoid colon and mesentery, and enlarged ventricles, as well as brain hemorrhage. A second case reported sacral disorder, malformed lower extremities, vertebral aplasia, renal agenesis, and atresic esophagus. These are only case reports, and this is not necessarily implying causality, but if cosmetic therapy in general we do not recommend using during the course of pregnancy. Also, the risk of systemic toxicity to Clostridium botulinum toxin is remote. Up to 1,200 units of botulinum toxin has been used for various medical conditions without negative effects. There have been 4 reports of mothers developing botulinum toxin in the developing world during the second and third trimester, and none of the fetuses were affected. In fact, the only movements in a mother that was totally paralyzed were those of the fetus kicking inside her, so the toxin does not appear to cross the placenta. In terms of hydroquinone, in sub-Saharan Africa, it is very common to apply hydroquinone for skin bleaching practices, and they use doses of 4 to 8% in the third trimester. 2/3 of mothers in that area of the world prepare for baptism by lightening their skin, and 50% of the time they also use clobetasol. There's a known risk in the lay community of poor healing on the abdomen, likely due to the use of the topical cortisone on the abdomen, so they avoid that area when they apply the lightening agents. There was no difference in pregnancy outcome with the skin lighteners, but there was an increased risk of low birth weight with the use of the clobetasol, so we tend not to recommend that during the course of pregnancy for skin lightening purposes. In terms of surgical procedures, both lidocaine only and lidocaine with epinephrine are considered safe. Epinephrine will reduce the placental transfer of lidocaine to the fetus, and also catecholamines are inactivated at the level of the placenta, so both lidocaine and epinephrine are acceptable to use for surgical procedures. So for final take-home points, be wary of Class B medications and be reasonable when you're describing Class C established medications with little proven risk. Avoid scaring your patients if a medication is necessary. Also, psoriasis will tend to improve without any medical therapy in pregnancy and will tend to worsen postpartum, so you need to be prepared to treat that flare postpartum. For your lupus patients, it's important to continue hydroxychloroquine throughout the pregnancy and consider IVIG for your pemphigus patients. In terms of topical steroids as well as antihistamines are considered safe in pregnancy for our atopic dermatitis patients. Biologics for patients with psoriasis, particularly the anti-TNF class, have mounting safety data to show their safety during pregnancy as well as during breastfeeding. IgG is an excellent choice for moderate to severe cases of pemphigus in pregnancy. And in terms of infectious therapy during pregnancy, there are many good choices for treatment of bacterial infections, and use the sensitivities from your culture to guide your therapeutic choice. Most oral antifungals are not safe in pregnancy, and most oral antivirals for herpes simplex infection are safe in pregnancy. You want to use destructive therapies such as liquid nitrogen for warts, and use permethrin or sulfur in petrolatum for scabies and occlusive therapy for lice. Finally, avoid cosmetic therapy in pregnancy if at all possible, and lidocaine with epinephrine is appropriate to use for localized procedures, and it's safe and well tolerated. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you, Dr. Marasse. That concludes this edition of Audio Digest Obstetrics and Gynecology. Our thanks to the speakers and to the meeting sponsors for their cooperation in the production of this program. Be sure to visit our website, audiodigest.org, to stay up to date on your continuing medical education credits. This program is copyright 2020.